Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books and Biography, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today, I'm speaking with Joseph F. O'Callaghan about his study of the Castilian King Alfonso X and the legal code he created, entitled Alfonso X, the Justinian of His Age, Law and Justice in 13th Century Castile. Joe, welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, Mark. I'm so glad to talk to you today. It's a nice day here.
And we're glad to have you on our channel today. I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
Okay, I'm a professor emeritus of medieval history at Fordham University now for probably more than 25 years. But during my academic career, I became particularly interested in the history of medieval Spain and eventually wrote a book about that. And in the course of writing that, I became interested in Alfonso X, who is known as El Sabio, the learned or the wise king. He was king of Castile in the second half of the 13th century, and he's a major figure in Spanish literature, among other things, because a group of men who worked for him, writing books of history and literature and poetry and law, and also doing scientific investigation. So he's a major figure there in the history of the intellectual history of Spain. So that's how I got into it. And that led me to, I wrote a biography of him, his reign actually some years ago. And then also I followed that up with a study of his work on the Cantigas de Santa Maria. The Cantigas de Santa Maria is a collection of about 400 poems in Galician, which is the language spoken in the northwest of Spain and in Portugal. But these are poems in recounting Virgin Mary, and my interest in them was to what extent did they actually reflect the king's personal life. So I worked on that, and then eventually this led me to the King's legal codes. Some years ago, my friend Father Robert Burns edited an English translation of the Siete Partidas, Alfonso's law code, and Father Burns asked me to write an introductory section for that. And so that interested me in the whole topic, and so that's basically how I got into this particular book, which is a study of law and justice as it's reflected in the king's in the Siete Partidas and other works that he produced. And incidentally, when I say he produced, what I mean to say is that he had a band of jurists, most of whom were anonymous, who did the body work for all of that. And some years ago, Edwin Proctor, who was a distinguished English historian, commented that Alfonso's role in all of this was to be a kind of a general editor supervising the work that was being done. So that's essentially how I got into this. So, Mark, go ahead.
Oh, thanks. One of the things I thought was fascinating was the point that you make early in the book, in which you distinguish exactly what Alfonso's achievement is, because in studying medieval history, there are plenty of kings who are making laws. And yet, as you explain, there's a difference between kings who are issuing laws and kings who are crafting entire legal codes. I was wondering if you could perhaps elaborate a bit upon what distinguishes the crafting of a legal code versus just issuing laws, and how many legal codes preceded Alfonso's issuance of his.
Okay. And in the title of my book, is Alfonso X, the Justinian of his age. And the Justinian in question is the Roman Emperor Justinian, who lived in the 6th century and put together a major code of law and several auxiliary books, for example, the Institutes and the Digest and so on. And that was essentially a major summation of Roman law as it existed at his time. And it's divided into books, and each book is divided into titles, and then each title is divided into individual laws of life and how the law applies to that. That was drawn up, and at that particular time, the Roman Empire had lost control over most of Western Europe. And so, for example, Spain, which had once been part of a province of the Roman Empire, was in the control of the Visigoths, who were one of the Germanic tribes that swept across Europe at that time.
You may hang.
Under the influence of many of the people, the Romans in Spain, produced a law code. It's called the Liber Judiciorum, or Book of Judges, or we simply call it today the Visigothic Code. But it's an attempt to summarize the whole body of law, and it reflects the outline of Justinian's titles and laws. And so that became the basic law used in the Visigothic Kingdom. However, the Visigothic Kingdom was overthrown by the Muslims early in the 8th century, and effectively destroyed. However, the Visigothic Code still survived, and it was used as a law by Christians who survived in Muslim Spain, and it was also carried northward into the eventual Kingdom of León, which came into being in the northwestern part of the Iberian Peninsula. So it was there and used there for some centuries. In the meantime, in regions to the east of León, customary law came to be prevalent. And customary law was basically oral, and a lot of it was influenced by Germanic tradition. Eventually, some of those customs began to be written down and came to be called fueros. That's F-U-E-R-O-S. It's a word derived from the Latin word forum, meaning a law. And so in the 11th and 12th centuries, as the Christians began to move southward from Castile and León and began to occupy territory that had once been Muslim, these collections of these fueros were written down, and they were given to different towns as their basic law. So you have a collection of municipal fueros operating in Old Castile and also in the area known as Extremadura. And that was more or less the situation in the 13th century, when Alfonso came to power. Alfonso's father, Fernando III, had actually extended the frontiers of the Kingdom of Castile to include much of what is now simple. He captured the city of Cordoba and also the city of Seville in 1248. And so Alfonso's job when he became king was to, first of all, consolidate his father's conquest. That meant bringing in Christian settlers into Cordoba and Seville and guaranteeing the security of the frontiers. But also, he became interested and concerned about the expansion of Spanish rule into Morocco. And that was a long-standing tradition that had been held over centuries. People believed that Morocco had a kingdom, and so the notion was that somehow or other that should be recovered and reintegrated into the kingdom of Castile and León. But aside from that, Alfonso was concerned to secure Morocco, a basis in Morocco, because he did not want Moroccans to be invading Spain. So his preoccupation at the beginning of his reign is securing the conquest of his father, planning a crusade in Africa, and also, in addition to everything else, getting himself elected as Holy Roman Emperor. So he had those three major activities on his agenda in the early part of his reign. And it was during that time that work was also begun on his law codes. The necessity to bring about some kind of unity or uniformity in the legal system, and had initiated the work, but the work was basically carried out and completed by Alfonso X. And as I say, he had employed a body of jurists, people trained in the law, to do it. So what happened was that his jurists produced three laws. One of them, and I'll give you the modern names, one is the Fuero Real, or Royal Law. The Especulo is the second one, and that's the Mirror of Law. And the third one is the Siete Partidas, which is actually, that's the seven parts, and that's actually a revision of the Especulo. So the first two were produced at about the same time, the Especulo and the Fuero Real. The Fuero Real was intended to be a municipal law, a law given to the towns of Castile and Extremadura, and to replace what they had. And the Especulo was a law code that the king kept in the royal court, and it was to be, as he said, a mirror of laws. In other words, the laws of the Fuero Real were reflected in the, they were a reflection of the Especulo, and were could be corrected and amended in accordance with the Especulo. However, while we have many copies of the Fuero Real, the Especulo survives today only, as far as we know, in one manuscript, and it's incomplete. It's five books in the Especulo. There are references to others, but we do not have them. Now, Alfonso, I believe, promulgated the Especulo and the Fuero Real of the land. The Fuero Real as a municipal law, and the Especulo as a law book that would regulate all other law books, and that was kept in the royal court. And what I'm arguing then is the Especulo was a complete work, even though we don't have the whole work today. But the king also claimed the right not only to make law, but also to amend it. So, for example, if he felt that the Especulo was needed to be amended or improved, he could do that. And that's what happened. In 1256, for example, he was recognized as the Holy Roman Emperor, and he was formally elected as such in 1257. And at that point, he set his jurists to work producing the work that came to be called the Siete Partidas. And the point of that was to emphasize his role as emperor. So that work was begun, according to the text itself, It was begun in 1256, and it was completed in 1265. So the Siete Partidas, in that sense, is a revision of the Especulo. And as I said, because the Especulo had been promulgated, the king did not see the necessity to have the Siete Partidas promulgated as well. It was simply a revision, an extension, a completion of the Especulo. In 1348, Alfonso the 11th declared that the Siete Partidas had not been promulgated, and so he, at that point, he gave it the force of law, and it has then since been accepted as such. But anyway, so the Siete Partidas then is the major law code that we're talking about. And by the reason why I called this book Alfonso X, the Justinian of his age, is because if you look over the history of medieval law, we have Justinian's code, which is a collection, a systematic treatment of law over in all of its aspects. And then you have Alfonso's Siete, which is also a comprehensive, systematic treatment of every aspect of the law. And I'll talk about the contents of that in a bit. But in the meantime, you have individual kings in different parts of Europe enacting specific laws on different topics, but not really producing a code in the sense of just, that's the reason for emphasizing that Alfonso is the Justinian of the 13th century, because his law code is a comprehensive, systematic treatment of every aspect of human life as it as reflected in the law. I should talk then, I guess, about the content of the Siete Partidas.
Oh, please do.
It's first of all, the king talks about it as the libro, and but it becomes to be called eventually toward the end of his life. He leaves it actually in his will. He mentions that he's leaving the septenario to his successors, and that term septenario means a book divided into seven parts, and that's how this came to be called the Siete Partidas. And it's, as I say, it's divided into seven parts. Each of the partidas is divided into titles, and each title is divided into laws, specific laws. So the first of those books, or partidas, deals with the notion of law itself. And of course, first of all, it emphasizes the king and emperor has the right to make law. So then it describes what law is and what's the difference between law and custom and so on, the differences between written and unwritten law. And then most of the first partita is actually devoted to, it kind of borrows from the books of canon law that were then current in the 13th century. The Decretum of Gratian, the work of Pope Gregory the Ninth, the Decretals, and so on. So it summarizes most of that, and that seems kind of incongruous in a book of laws here in for a kingdom. But I think Alfonso had a concept of law that was unified, and saw this as part of the law, and also saw it as part of his responsibility as a Christian king to uphold and defend the Christian church. So I think that's the reason for including the canon law in the first of the partidas. The second partida is probably the most interesting. Focuses on the king himself. It focuses on the king himself and the members of his family, but it also draws on philosophy and theology. It talks, for example, Aristotle, and it borrows from the Bible, a lot of quotations from the Bible, and a lot of other writers. It also uses the earlier writings of the Visigothic Code and people like Saint Isidore of Seville and so on. But anyway, in that, he's talking about the role of the king, how the king comes to be, how the king is made. Incidentally, the kings of Castile were not crowned and anointed generally as were the kings in France and England. The king is essentially acclaimed by the assembly of bishops and nobles and townspeople, and that's how he became a king. So he talks about the role of the king and emphasizes his relationship with God. He is God's vicar on earth. He rules by the grace of God, and his title is Alfonso, King by the Grace of God. And the point of that is that he emphasizes that he owes his position to God's favor, and he is responsible to God for how he conducts his business. So that idea kind of pervades most of what he has to say about the fact that the king is much like the emperor. He has in his own kingdom, he has the same power that an emperor has in his kingdom, and that he is responsible for the welfare and the common good of his people. And the common good is a consistent theme that runs through his work. That's his main job, is to foster the common good and to see to it that justice is done to every person. That, again, that phrase, the being rendering to everyone is due, runs through all of the Partidas. It's essentially what the king is concerned with. Initial Partida, he also talks about he talks about not only the king and what sort of person, how the king should conduct himself. He should be a person who is learned, illiterate, a person who is concerned about learning new things all the time, someone who is attentive to the saberes. The saberes, by that he means the sciences, all of the subjects of study that are useful for being a ruler, constantly be on the alert to learn new things. So he talks about that and how the king should conduct himself. And then he talks about the king's relationship with his family. And that, in many respects, the importance of that is that he wants to transmit his power to his children, his heirs. So in order to do that, he has to choose a wife who has certain qualities. She should be noble and beautiful and courteous and loving and all those kinds of things. So he talks about all of that. And then he talks about how should be educated, how they will teach them the things that they need to know to be good people in this world. And, of course, particularly he's concerned about his sons and, most importantly, his oldest son, who will be the heir to the throne. So there's a great deal of emphasis on that sort of thing. In addition to that, he talks about his relationships with his brothers. And he had several brothers, but they didn't get along too well. There was a lot of sibling rivalry, and he had his brother Enrique rebelled against him, and his brother Federico eventually followed Enrique to Sicily, and later came back and was involved in Spain. And then the younger brother Manuel, both of those play a role in the king's later activity. But so he's talking about how you bring together that family and how that family then creates a dynasty, perpetuate its power and authority. Now, in addition to that, he talks about the administrative apparatus. The king has to rule with the guidance and the assistance of his court. And the court includes mostly nobles and bishops and also people that you would call letrados, learned men, men who are of a middling background, but who are scholars, people who are literate and who know something about law and about different aspects of life. So those are the people that he brings into his court. And some of them have specific jobs, important jobs. There's a mayordomo, for example, who is normally responsible for all of the financial aspects of the administration. The alferez, who is a military leader, primarily. These are positions that are given usually to members. The office of chancellor, I should say, the office of the chancery, technically, the Archbishop of Toledo, for example, holds the title of archbishop, the title of chancellor, but in practical terms, the chancery is run by notaries. There's a notary for Castile and there's a notary for Leon, and they supervise a body of scribes whose job it is to write up all the documents that the king produces. These include grants to churches, to monasteries, to towns, all sorts of stuff like that. All the public documents are recorded by this, written by the scribes. They're supervised by the notaries, make sure that they're authentic, and they are also registered in books so that the king knows what he has actually agreed to. And then original copies of those texts are given out to the town or the bishops or the monasteries or whoever the recipients are. So that's one of the major offices of public affairs. And incidentally, there are in the Partidas, there are a whole lot of formulae that you can use for different kinds of purposes, legal documents. In other words, the formulas are right there for Partidas and use them, for example, or sales or things of that sort. Now, in addition to all of that, the king talks too about treason, and treason is a topic that comes up again and again and again. He's very much concerned about people betraying him in different ways. And of course, the punishment for treason is very serious. Depending on the crime, I mean, the extent of the crime, it can result in the confiscation of one's property, or being sent into exile, or being executed. And the prime example of that is his brother Frederike. Frederike had gone off to Sicily and then eventually came back to Spain. But in 1277, the king executed him without a trial. And the question is, why did he do that? And it would seem that at that point, Frederike was probably angling to take control of the government in some way or other, because Alfonso himself was becoming ill and rather erratic at that time. So anyway, so he was executed. Now and the opposite part of treason, which is discussed as well in the Partidas, is the notion of tyranny. And here you have an example of that. People, a tyrant, because he levies heavy taxes to finance his activities, and also because they object to these newfangled laws that he's producing, and they object to things like the execution of his brother Frederike and some other instances of that sort of behavior. So that's tyrannical behavior, and that ultimately brings about the king's downfall. In 1282, and now let me explain, first of all, before that, he also has to deal with the problem of succession to the throne. He had a son, Fernando de la Cerda, who was a bright young man, but died suddenly in 1275, on his way to the frontier to overthrow or to halt an invasion from Morocco. But he died in the process of that journey southward. And so the king's problem then was, who do we designate as successor? Fernando de la Ferra had a young son, a child, Alfonso de la Ferra, and he could have been named as the heir to the throne, and in fact the Siete Partidas accepted that as the way it should be done. But a five-year-old, an ailing king, and with an invading army from Morocco, was not the best possible choice. So instead, the king named his second son, Sancho, as king, as the heir to the throne. And Sancho had the backing of the king's youngest brother, Manuel. And that worked out okay for a couple of years. But then in 1282, Sancho and decided to rebel against his father, and he did so because the father decided to make to divide the kingdom, actually, to make provision for giving parts of the kingdom to Alfonso de la Cerda and so on. So Sancho rebelled against him, and in 1282, with the support of Infante Manuel and the support of the queen, Violante, the estates of the realm dispossessed Alfonso X of royal authority. They let him have the title of king, but they took away all of the basic functions of kingship and transferred them to Sancho. And what that did effectively was to divide the kingdom and put it into civil war for about 2 years until the king died in 1284. So it's interesting that while he had worked so very hard to produce this law code that was going to bring everybody together in harmony, his violation of certain aspects of that law code eventually led to his own downfall.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So, if I may interject, I had to say that, you know, as I was reading your book, that was one of the things I thought was really fascinating about what you did, which is that, you know, you could have simply have talked about the laws that Alfonso wrote. But what you do in the book, which is I thought was really fascinating, was you integrated into those experiences of his reign, both showing the degree to which his conception, you know, the provisions reflected Alfonso's experiences, and also how they came into play as his reign went on. So you're talking about basically the legal code as a living body that's the product of his, you know, conception or the experiences of his reign, and not just say a distillation of ideas or something that was entirely abstract, which had no real grounding in the times in which they were written.
Well, a law book is a book of regulations, and as everybody knows, you can have all the regulations you want, but then do you actually enforce them? And one of the things that I was concerned about in doing this was not only to talk about what was actually in this law book, but also to see to what extent could I show from other kinds of, and that was, I was able to do that in some instances, in other instances, instances no. But anyway, what you have here, I talked about the notion of kinship and all of that sort of thing, but then you have the practical issues. For example, there's the third partita that talks about how you bring a suit in court, and the important point there is that in the early Middle Ages, in the Germanic society, if you wanted to sue somebody, you, it was pretty much on your own to do that. You didn't have too much support other than from your immediate family. But with Alfonso, he emphasizes that the judges are, he will appoint the judges. And the reason for that is he wants the judges to apply the law in the siete partidas. He doesn't want them doing anything off the top of their heads or at whim or whatever. So the judges listen to legal cases in towns and so on are appointed by the king. The scribes that record the work of the courts are also appointed by the king. And anyway, then he describes the whole process, and basically it's a written process. It's reflective, really, of the process used in Roman and canon law. So it's written, a written process, but it involves, for example, the presentation by the plaintiff of a written demand, and then a response by the defendant. And then the business is dealt with in a court, and the judge eventually has to listen to witnesses, if there are any. And sometimes that may also mean using an inquest. So an inquest is a major tool of the king for ferreting out truth about all kinds of issues. And what an inquest is you're bringing together a fairly large group of people from a different from a particular locality, and then asking them to state what they know about a particular issue, and on the basis of that, then the judge can make a decision. So inquests are a very important tool for the king, and it's also one of the things that people complain about. In 1281, for example, the Cortes of Seville complains about false inquests. In other words, they're objecting to the probing nature of these inquiries that the king is carrying out. And then besides inquests, you have the use of documents. You produce a document that justifies whatever claim you may have. The problem with that is, how do we know that the document you produce is authentic? And if it's the original document, it ought to have the king's seal on it, but it may not have that. It may be a copy. And then you can also check it in the registers that the king has kept of charters that he's issued. So that may work out okay. But anyway, on the basis of all that, then the court makes a decision. And if you are one of the litigants and you don't like it, you can appeal, and the appeal goes to the king, to the king's court, to the king himself. And of course, he's got professional judges in his court who hear appeals of that kind of stuff. So there's a lot of that. Incidentally, there's a long litigation involving the monastery of Oña, which is up in Old Castile, and they produce these inquests, and they have something like, I think, 100 people from the locality called in to give testimony about the issues in dispute. So there's that. You have that whole process. That how do you actually bring your case to court, and how is it solved? So the king works out all the details of that in the law code, and then the other parts of the code deal with the law of persons and the law of property, and that's reflective of a Roman comment that the law concerns persons, property, and actions, and the actions would be the court's court process. But anyway, so you have under the law of persons, there's a whole treatment of the issue of marriage and family, children, legitimate children, illegitimate children, guardianship of children, all of those kinds of things. There's also something that's rather peculiar that is discussed there as well, and it's called baragania. And what that is it's essentially a form of concubinage. In other words, it's not a marriage in the traditional sense. And incidentally, on the marriage aspects of it, mostly by this time, the marriage is solemnized in the church. So the church has kind of taken over the whole process of how you get married. But baragania is something apart from that. And it's basically a long-term relationship that a man has with a woman. And it's very much akin to marriage. And in fact, the king himself has had affairs with several women, but one in particular, it seems to be a long-lasting marriage, and I think is kind of an example of this sort of baragania. So that's discussed in the code as well. And also, the code reflects the Roman idea of pater familias. In other words, the father is the head of the family, and for all practical purposes, his word is law. So he not only controls his wife and his children, but he controls everybody in his household, and nothing is done without his consent and his approval. And women in general are in a state of protection. They are protected by their parents, their father, and then when they get married, they come under the protection of their husbands, and in some respects, they really get their greatest sense of freedom when they become widows. But anyway, so that whole business of marriage and family is a major part of the thing, the law code, and that leads to the discussion about the inheritance, the family, the reason for the family coming together is to preserve and maintain its property, its estate, and then you have to make sure that that gets into the proper hands, and that's done by drawing up wills and designating heirs and so on. And again, that reflects pretty much the Roman guidelines on that particular issue. So that's part of it. And then there's a whole section that deals with lords and vassals. This is lords and vassals is a major aspect of medieval society anyway. And so there's a long part of the work that deals with that. There also is much talk about the juridical capacity of people. In other words, what that means is, do you have any kind of standing before the law? If you were a child, for example, you don't really have juridical capacity. Your parents or your guardian acts in your name, or woman, her husband acts in her name or her father. So juridical capacity is limited. And incidentally, Jews and Muslims don't have equal standing with Christians, because this is essentially a Christian society, so that they're treated as a separate group. But anyway, also in that whole aspect of the law of persons, there's much attention given to slavery. And slavery means, or as a result really of the warfare going on along the frontier between Christians and Muslims. And that's been going on for centuries. So if you lived on the frontier, you ran the risk of being captured either by the Christians or by the Muslims. So a lot of Christian slaves ended up in the Kingdom of Granada, or else they ended up in Morocco. And at the same time, a lot of Muslims were captured, and they were enslaved and handed over to nobles and monasteries and convents and places like that. So there's much discussion in there about the rights of slaves and the treatment of slaves, and then also about a whole process of manumission and how you can free the slaves. And then what's the status of a freedman? A freedman, for example, is supposed to be on good terms with his former master. I'm sure that didn't always work out, but anyways, it's one of the aspects of this. So that whole area of the law of persons is dealt with. And then there's much talk about the matter of property, ownership of property, possession of property, how that works out. And then the different kinds of contracts that are entered into by people. For example, leases of property, the sales of property. How is all that handled and regulated? And there are many, many examples of that kind of thing. Exchanges of property, and so on. So that's all dealt with as well. And what else? Then the king, too, is concerned about commercial activity. He welcomes trade with other people from other areas, other kingdoms, other regions, because he recognizes that that's going to be a benefit to his own kingdom. But he also regulates a lot of that. So, for example, there are laws that regulate weights and measures. There's an attempt on his part to establish coinage that will be acceptable and useful. And he regulates money lending. Money lending was basically something that Christians were not supposed to. Christians were allowed to lend money, obviously, but they were not supposed to be taking interest or usury. That was something that Christians were not supposed to do. But what happens then is you have Jewish money lenders who were allowed to take interest. So the king regulates that. But also you find that the Christians oftentimes will arrange for loans, and then we'll have clauses in the loans, for example, that say, well, if the money is not paid on a particular date, then there's a penalty, and the penalty basically is interest, and both parties pretty much knew all about that. And the king also regulated the formation of guilds. He was willing to have guilds, but they had to be under his control. And he wanted also to, he regulated mercantile companies. So his concern here is to emphasize royal authority in all of these areas and not to allow everyone to pursue his own particular interest, but rather to try to reach the interests of the community as a whole. And the last part of that, my book is on crime and punishment. Obviously, a law code has to deal with crime, and there are numerous examples of that that the king cites, the whole raft of crimes from treason, murder, all the sexual crimes, adultery, fornication. Homosexuality is condemned vigorously, and it's even stated that the tolerance of some homosexuality is going to lead to bad things for the kingdom. So it's a very negative view of that entirely. And then all the different kinds of frauds and scams that people come up with. One interesting thing there is they talk about the scam involving you want to borrow some money from somebody, and you present as collateral a chest that's supposedly filled with valuable goods, and it turns out that the chest is actually filled with sand. Well, that's essentially the scam that the Cid carried out against the Jews in Burgos. He needed money, and he did exactly that, and that whole notion is mentioned in the Partidas. So a lot of stuff on criminal behavior, and it obviously that society was reflective of, the kind of crimes that still happen every other day in every part of the world. So look, that's more or less, I think, an overview. I ended my book with a comment on how the Siete Partidas, the impact of the Siete Partidas on our own world. And what I would say here is that it's a law book that was obviously written for the benefit of the people in the Kingdom of Castile-Leon, but during the king's own lifetime, or shortly after his lifetime, I should say, there were attempts made to translate it into Portuguese and also into Catalan, and it had some impact on the development of law in those two areas. But also, it becomes the fundamental law then in all those parts of the world that were colonized by the Spanish people. So all of Latin America and so on. And a number of scholars have studied the impact of the Siete Partidas in their country. So, for example, there are instances, for example, when after the Latin countries began to declare their independence of Spain in the 19th century, they had to decide what kind of law they were going to follow. And what they did in many cases was to draw up lists of bodies of law and what precedents they would have. So the Siete Partidas is listed as a fundamental body of law that's to be followed in places like Mexico, for example, or Peru and so on. So but a lot of that. But also, it's the Partidas is also used in parts of the United States that were brought under Spanish rule. And specifically, as examples of that, you have Louisiana, Texas, and California. In fact, in the early part of the 19th century, Louisiana, the people in Louisiana decided that a translation of the Siete Partidas into English would be useful because so much of the law of Louisiana was based on the Partidas. So that was produced. It wasn't a complete translation, but because it left out, for example, the Book of the Canon Law parts. But anyway, and then, of course, in Texas and in California, the Partidas were cited in cases involving the possession of land, the mines, and things of that sort. And there's even a reference in one case. Father Burns, by the way, did a study of some of this work, but there's one case involving the Siete Partidas when it's cited by the Supreme Court Justice Rehnquist. He mentions in an opinion he wrote on this about the Siete Partidas. So it's a body of law that's produced in the 13th century. It's a code of law. It's really the only true code of law written in the medieval period, aside from Justinian's code. So it's really reflective of that. And it has this tremendous worldwide impact because it's applied in all of those areas that Spain eventually dominated. So it's an extraordinary body of work. And as I say, the irony of all of this is that the king who produced it, Alfonso X, eventually fell afoul of the law because he violated it himself. He did not give due process to his brother, whom he executed without a trial, and that was held against him, and so on. So, anyway, What else can I say, Mark?
Well, you've said it all. You've demonstrated just how comprehensive the code is and how much it covered, and also its considerable legacy. My only question remaining is, what are you working on now?
I'm working on odds and ends of things. Books of law that has come down to us is called the Leyes del Estilo, the laws, literally the laws of style. What this is it's an anonymous body of work, and it probably dates from the end of Alfonso's reign and the early part of the 14th century. And it's concerned with the literally how the royal court handled different kinds of legal situations. So I'm trying to make sense out of that. It deals with, for example, debts and contracts of different sorts, how people respond to summons to the court, how you deal with crimes and things of that kind of stuff. Also, it has a lot on the treatment of Jews. And I forgot to mention, by the way, that throughout Alfonso's codes, he's talking about Jews and Muslims, and essentially they are not subject to this code because they are recognized as having their own laws and being having the right to be judged according to their own law, and to follow. They're also allowed to be to worship freely. But their contact with Christians is limited in many ways, and particularly when you come into the issue of a conflict between a Christian, for example, and a Jew, or a Christian and a Muslim, then the balance of power there is on the side of the Christian. But there are oaths, for example, that Jews and Muslims have to swear when they are brought into court, and those oaths are specifically tailored to their religious beliefs. So if you're a Jew, this is a kind of oath you have to swear, and it refers to the prophets of the Old Testament. And if you're a Muslim, that's another kind of code or oath that you have to swear to as well. So anyway, what I'm doing is this, trying to see what I can make sense of this collection of laws reflecting the operation of the royal court at the end of Alfonso's reign and the beginning of 14th century. And what I'll do with that, I have no idea.
Well, it does sound like a very fascinating project, and I do wish you the best of luck with it. Joe, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
All right. Thank you very much, Mark. Appreciate this.